Julian Bond. He's been a civil rights activist for a long time, from his work in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, starting in 1960, to his current role as chair of the board of the NAACP. Some of our listeners may remember that Julian Bond was elected to the Georgia House of Representatives in 1965 as an anti-war and civil rights candidate. There were some people who didn't want him to take his seat, but eventually he was seated and served there and in the Georgia State Senate until 1987. Today, he's Distinguished Scholar in Residence at American University and Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Julian Bond, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you were one of the students in 1960 who formed SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Today, students in American history courses, like the one that I teach, learn about SNCC's critique of the NAACP. The NAACP relied on the courts to bring gradual progress in challenging segregation, while SNCC did grassroots organizing of ordinary black people in the heartland of segregation for nonviolent direct action to end segregation. Now SNCC is long gone and you are chair of the NAACP. What happened?
Well, two things happened. One, I think that we early critics, while right in some respects, we're wrong in our analysis of what the NAACP really was. In fact, when SNCC workers went into rural Alabama, Mississippi, and Georgia, it was NAACP members who provided the underpinning for the kind of organizing work they did and who for many, many years had been quietly and without any news coverage or any attention from anyone except the NAACP itself, had been going about the very, very dangerous work of trying to build a civil rights movement. And secondly, in the 1970s, when I joined the Atlanta NAACP, after having been a youth member as a high school kid, but being inactive from then until I was in my 30s, when I joined the Atlanta NAACP, it was the only soldier left standing. All of the other organizations, like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, had gone away or it withered and were shadows of their former selves. I wanted to be with something with staying power, and now this organization has been around for 92 years, and heaven forbid it has to be around for 92 more, but if it must, it will be.
You take up this history in a new essay titled The Movement We Helped to Make. It's in a book called Long Time Gone, 60s America, Then and Now. It's edited by Alexander Bloom. There you write about how SNCC went to places where Martin Luther King never went, especially the small towns of Mississippi. Tell us a little bit about what these SNCC campaigns were like. What were their goals? How did you guys manage to survive down there?
Well, first I ought to say that Dr. King's absence isn't any reflection on him or his courage. It's simply that there were many, many more of us than there were of him. He was a single individual, couldn't be everywhere all of the time. At our top, there must have been nearly 800 of us. If you look at the summer of 1964, and at other times, say 250 of us. So we could be almost everywhere. Typically, when a SNCC worker went into one of these little towns in Alabama, Mississippi, or Georgia, he or she came armed with a great deal of research conducted by the SNCC Research Department. So we knew who the leading economic figures in a community might be. We knew who the banker was, who the biggest merchant was, who the political figures were. And more importantly than that, I think, or equally as important, we knew the economic ties they had to the larger world. So we knew, for example, that the Queen of England had a small interest in a plantation in Mississippi.
Amazing.
Yes, it really was amazing and just showed how far-reaching the apparatus was and how strongly it would defend itself against our attack. So the person went into a community, knew a great deal about it before he or she ever got there, and when he or she got there, he usually knew some NAACP contacts. Early on supplied to us by Ella Baker, who was one of the adult founders of SNCC and a longtime advisor. But she had traveled the region for 10 years as NAACP field secretary early in the 20th century, and she knew people in all these little towns and cities, and people with whom we could stay, people who were leading the good fight in their communities, so we didn't go in cold. The early days would be spent just walking around, introducing yourself to people. Hello, my name is John Smith. I want to see what's going on in town, and letting people say, here's what we think the problem is, here's what we think needs to be done, rather than saying, here I am with a program that's going to save you. And time after time and town after town, it proved to be successful.
We're speaking with Julian Bond, the longtime civil rights activist. He's the author of a new essay called The Movement We Helped to Make. It appears in a book called Long Time Gone, 60s America, Then and Now. Julian Bond, SNCC in the 60s not only had this critique of the NAACP, it also had some criticisms of Martin Luther King. Remind us what they were and whether today you think they had any legitimacy at all.
I think they had some legitimacy today when I look back over it, and I was among the harshest critics. Our typical criticism was of the aura of self-importance that grew up around him, not fostered by him himself, but by others around him. He was surrounded by a circle of people, including some sycophants and yes men, people who would make way for him in crowds saying, here comes the leader, here comes the leader. We objected to the idea that there was a leader of African Americans or Negroes or black people, as we said then. We thought there were and should be multiple leaders, and the notion that one man, one individual could represent this massive, massive race of so many different people living in so many different places and thinking and believing so many different things was just an anathema to us. So we very much resented that. And we also resented the technique that he used. SCLC, his organization, typically believed that what you do in a place like Birmingham is come in, get together with local activists, create some kind of crisis using nonviolent demonstrations, bring things to a boil, hopefully forcing the power structure to the negotiating table, negotiate a settlement, and move away. And that worked. It was a good idea. It worked time and time again. Our criticism of it was that it didn't leave anything behind, that once King and his minions had left town and gone on to the next town, there was no cohesive movement left behind. We thought our method of this painstaking, months-long, sometimes years-long organizing left behind a movement that would continue on after we had gone. Looking back at it from the vantage point of today, I now see that we're both right and that it took a combination of what he did and what we did to make these movements succeed. But then I was young. What did I know?
I also wanted to ask about Vietnam. Of course, the civil rights movement of the 60s coincided with the war in Vietnam. In the mid-60s, this seemed like completely separate issues to most people. There was foreign policy and there was domestic policy. You and your fellow SNCC workers were some of the first to make the connections. What did you see was the connection?
Well, there are a couple of things. One was, I think, there's this long strain of interest in Africa among African Americans, going back to slavery even, where some slaves maintained their ties to Africa, the Muslim faith, the names, the customs, the habits, even some of the foods. And continuing on into the 1960s, organizations and groups that had an interest in Africa, most of them small and relatively influential, but nevertheless, a strong current. Then there are all these African students attending African-American colleges and universities, and they, you know, were constantly scornful of African-Americans, saying, hey, we're ruling our countries, we're overthrowing the colonial governments. So there was this base for some interest in the world outside American borders even before the war came along. And when the war did come along, initially, you know, thinking about it, the first impingement on our lives was the draft. And the fact that so many black young men seemed to be sucked away from what we thought was another war that had more compelling reasons to be fought here, the war against racism, the war against segregation. I think it's only later that we began to think about the money drain rather than the people drain, but the combination of the money drain and the people drain just heightened our interest in investigating this war. It soon became clear to us, at least we thought it was clear, that the United States was fighting on the wrong side, and that the sooner we withdrew, the better off the Vietnamese would be, and certainly the better off America would be.
Julian Bond, in 1965, you decided to run for the Georgia State House of Representatives. This was a wildly radical idea at the time. Tell us what kind of campaign you ran, and then what happened after you won.
Well, I ran the kind of door-to-door campaign that we had run in our organizing campaigns in the rural South, in the small town South. Luckily for me, the House district I was running for was relatively small. I could walk across it in a couple of hours. I could, without an enormous amount of effort, literally knock on every door and talk to every household. And so I did that. I got a great deal of help from my friends in SNCC who would come in from their field work for a weekend and spend a day canvassing with me. excuse me. I doubt if I spent $1,000 in that first race for office.
How times have changed.
Oh, indeed so. And then about a month before I was to take office, one of my colleagues in SNCC, a young man named Samuel Young, a veteran of the Navy, a man who had lost his kidney in a shipboard explosion, not in combat, as a consequence had to go to the bathroom more than most people do, tried to go to the bathroom in his hometown of Tuskegee, Alabama, in a white-only toilet at a gas station, and the gas station owner shot him in the back and killed him. Well, the irony of this guy losing his life after losing his kidney in service to his country was just too great, and all of this anti-war sentiment, which had already bubbled a bit to the surface, just bubbled out and came out in a statement against the war in Vietnam, which my colleagues-to-be in the Georgia House of Representatives for some reason objected to it so strongly that they voted to put me out. I ran for the vacancy created by my absence. I won that. They put me out again. I ran again for a third time and in the interim filed a lawsuit. Eventually, it was heard by the United States Supreme Court, and I won that. And a year after I had first been elected and after two subsequent elections, I finally took my seat.
We're speaking with Julian Bond, a longtime civil rights activist. He's got an essay about the history of SNCC and the civil rights movement in the 60s in a new book called Long Time Gone, 60s America, Then and Now. How do you explain the end of SNCC?
Well, I think a combination of things. I don't think we know now the degree to which the police apparatus of the federal government, the FBI and the CIA and the intelligence agencies of local police departments, we don't know the degree to which they engaged in disruptive tactics, turning SNCC member against SNCC member, having people make extraordinarily outrageous comments, which, of course, just brought down further ire and wrath of the larger world upon our heads, not to say that we weren't capable of doing those on our own. So we don't know how much that had to do with the eventual demise, and we really don't know how much just plain tiredness had to do with it. But accounting for those two possible influences, the third thing was a serious rift between people who wanted to continue the kind of black and white together, hand in hand, we shall overcome hopefulness of the early 1960s, and those who wanted to see a division of labor with blacks organizing in black America, whites organizing in white America, hopefully so that these communities could grow in anti-racist strength and at one time in the future join together, hopefully, and that rift was just too great to overcome, and the organization foundered. White students, white SNCC members asked to leave the organization to do this kind of work. Some agreed to do so. Others resisted it. Others tried to appear neutral, whatever the group wanted. It just was a combination of all these factors, and it's hard to say, for me to say at any rate, which of them was the greater, but all of them contributed to the downfall of what was, I think, one of the wonderful organizations of the 1960s.
As Julian Bond, we've only got a minute or two left here. You end this new essay writing, quote, "For too many people today, the fight for equal justice has become a spectator sport, a kind of national basketball association in which all the players are black and the spectators are white." Explain what you mean.
Well, I'm head of the biggest and oldest civil rights organization in the country, the NAACP. We have more than half a million members. We don't have a racial breakdown, but I'd bet that 90% of them are African Americans. We have very few white members, only two white members of a 64-member board of directors. When the 60s were in flower, the civil rights movement of the 60s was in flower, there were abundant number of leading white Americans who were part of this movement, not only as grassroots participants, but as spokesperson, religious figures, labor figures, and others. Those people are absent today, or if they're present, they aren't making sufficient noise about what I take to be one of the most pressing issues facing Americans, and that's racial division. Too many people stand on the sidelines and applaud. I get lots of helpful comments. Good work. You're doing great. Keep it up. But I want people to be marching beside me, not simply standing back applauding. And, you know, that's one of the challenges, I think, of the 1990s and now the 2000s. How do we engage the American majority in this kind of work? How do we make them see that this is their work, too, that they have a role to play in this? We need them.
Julian Bond, it's been great talking with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.